So, Rashi, how'd you make out in the rapture last week?
Yeah, I didn't do so great. They rescheduled it, so far it's just a lot of wasted money on good Bibles.
Well, you didn't spend money on the Bibles. You stole those out of hotel drawers, I understand.
I didn't say it was my money. It was the Gideon's money.
Oh, okay. Well, that's too bad for the Gideons. You know, Super Rico's still out there by the corner with a little handheld cardboard sign that says heaven on it. He's still hoping to get out of this mess.
Yeah, but he's been getting free roller skating lessons from Roller Skating Jesus, so all is not lost for him. I'm the only one getting screwed.
Who's a Roller Skating Jesus? He's like one of those guys in front of the Chinese theater that
you... Yeah, his name is Herbert Smith.
Herbert Smith, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I
guess you can rent him out for parties. We should have him over for Halloween. Oh, no, wait, because they rescheduled the rapture for the 21st. Gosh, I'm just getting screwed all around.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of Radio Rashi. I'm Paul Dini.
I'm Misty Lee, and I am so stoked. We have Mark Evanier here, guys.
Yeah. That's right, Emily. That's right.
Everyone's so excited.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, mix in some applause and some sound effects. And
don't mix in applause.
Yeah, mix in applause and leave this conversation in. So mix it in now. There we go. Not awkward at all.
No. Mark is a very dear friend. I've known him for years. Misty, you haven't known him for quite as long, but still.
But I've loved him more than you.
Yes, that's right.
There we go.
And you will never find a greater, more knowledgeable source about entertainment, comics, animation in this whole world than Mark Evanier.
I'm in deep trouble now.
Welcome.
Enormous trouble.
Thank you for venturing into our little snake pit here. you and I have actually, interviewed each other before for comic conventions. I think there was like a WonderCon where you and I interviewed each other. We've done a
couple of panels.
Yeah, that was always fun.
How did you guys meet?
I don't know.
How did
we meet?
I do remember how we met, and it was, I was taken to a CAPS meeting, I believe by Gordon Kent, and I was working at Filmation, and this is like in 1980, and they were working on, they had a character there, they were doing a Mighty Mouse series, and they had a character called Quackula, which was a ripoff of Dracula, but it was also a ripoff of, there was a villain in Danger Mouse, it was very similar, but it was also a big lift from a character Scott Shaw had created called Duckula. And I remember Gordon introducing us, and I remember seeing Scott Shaw there, and I remember saying, please don't say I'm working on Quackula. And I think he went up and said, I'd like to introduce a new writer, Paul Dini, who's working on Quackula for a Filmation.
Oh, okay.
And Scott was like looking daggers at me because he had his lawyers call Filmation about that. But it was like, oh, great. Everybody hates me now. But
he took legal action on that.
Yeah.
And I was actually a witness in that case.
Mm. It was very close because his character Duckula had an assistant called Bears and Bolts, who was a bear like version of Frankenstein.
That's really funny.
And yes, and in Quackula, he lived in a house where he tormented a bear who looked very similar, even though he wasn't a Frankenstein bear. It was very, very close. It was
well, as I recall, what actually motivated it was the people who worked for Filmation were going up to Scott at comic conventions and saying, "Hey, your comics are all over the place. We were told to rip them off."
Oh, really?
Yes. So he got a lawyer, and I think he settled out of court, as I recall. But, what could you get out of Filmation? $112.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
So you guys have known each other forever. Have you ever worked together in anything?
Superman.
That's right, yeah, the Superman show.
We worked
show.
On Superman.
The Adventures of Superman animated series.
Bringing in the Apocalypse characters into
right.
Superman. You wrote
nice.
A few of those?
Yes.
Gerber wrote a few of those, I
yes,
think?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because you were associated with Jack Kirby for a while.
That's right. I was, Jack Kirby, I remember that name, yes.
So for the people who don't know who Jack is at home, will you enlighten them?
We don't want to talk to those people. We don't want those people listening.
Time. Those are trolls and troglodytes and...
we don't care.
I kind of don't.
Jack Kirby was, I always hate to say mentor because... That makes it sound like I got some of his skills, which I didn't. But Jack was, I think, the most important creative force in comic books, at least of adventure and superhero kind of comics.
Oh, definitely.
And
you're here.
he was more than just an artist. He was a great artist, but he was also a creator and an inventor and a visionary. And I was his assistant for a few years and became a close friend of his. And I have a book out about his life and just an amazing man. I've been fortunate to know a lot of amazing people. You don't have to be that good if you can hang around people who are really spectacular.
Yeah, and you really don't hang around sluffs, you know? I mean, can we please start this with Try the Whitefish? Can we please?
You want that story? Okay.
I love that story.
Yeah.
I don't think you guys have heard this, have you?
No.
Okay.
I am about 15 or 16 years old in this. My family was, nobody in my family was in show business, but we knew a lot of people who were either in show business. We had connections here and there with people who were in show business, or we knew a couple of wealthy people. And we had these friends named the Zuckers, Mr. and Mrs. Zucker, who had so much money they had to store it on microfilm. And they were members of Hillcrest Country Club, which was the Jewish themed, the country club that the Jews built in Los Angeles when they were told they couldn't be in the LA country club.
Yeah.
So one Saturday, I think it was a Saturday or Sunday, we were taken there for brunch, and I walked in, and there's on the right the Comedians Roundtable. Jack Benny, George Burns, Milton Berle, Phil Silvers, Jan Murray. I think Larry Gelbart was there, a couple of people I couldn't identify.
Man.
And the one person I kind of would have liked to have seen wasn't there. So about half an hour later, I go up to the buffet to load my plate for the 14th time or whatever it was. And I'm waiting for them to bring out more breakfast steaks or whatever they were bringing out. And the man standing next to me says to me, "Try the Whitefish." And I look over, and it's Groucho Marx. If I had seen Groucho Marx someplace in the room, I would not have gone up to him. I would not have had the guts to go up to him and say hello. Mm-hmm. So I was just kind of standing there going, "Oh my goodness, Groucho Marx is talking to me." And I said, "Excuse me?" And he said, "Try the Whitefish." And I said, "I thought the password was swordfish." he giggled. I remember, I made Groucho Marx giggle.
Yeah.
And he said, "Are you one of those kids who's seen every one of my movies 100 times?" And I said, 1,000 times. He said, "Which one is your favorite?" I said, "Well, probably either Horse Feathers or Night at the Opera, depending which one I've seen most recently." He said, "Which one have you seen most recently?" I said, "A Night in Casablanca." He said, "Oh, that one was a piece of crap." And we stood there and talked for about 20 minutes for no reason other than he just enjoyed talking to me. And, of course, I wasn't going to not talk to him.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the most memorable quote was, I told him that, and this was true, that I was taking dates to see Marx Brothers movies. This was before home video. This was when it was a rare occasion to be able to see Marx Brothers movie.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of local theaters were showing them because they were cheap.
Yeah.
So I was taking, this was my way to get dates, I would say to a young lady, "Have you ever seen a Marx Brothers movie?" And she'd go, "Oh no, I've heard of those. What are they?" And I go, "Well, I'll take you to one." So I told him I was taking my dates to Marx Brothers movies. And he said, "Are you getting laid?" And I wasn't, but I said, "Sure, yeah, okay. You know, what guy isn't a teenage doesn't say yes?" That's the question. And he said, "Imagine young kids getting laid because of my movies. I couldn't get laid because of them." That's basically the story. I met Groucho a few other times after that, but that first time was...
Wow.
It was the first time in my life I'd ever met someone I was really in awe of. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, after you meet Groucho Marx, who is there to be impressed by?
Yeah.
And it's a great name drop, you know.
Yeah.
Well, as I was telling Groucho, nobody goes, "Groucho who?"
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's the story.
But he's not the only comedian that you made laugh, because you actually wrote a joke. And I don't know if you... Did you sell the joke to somebody on was it an escalator? Do you know what
about? Oh, that one. Yeah. No, I didn't sell it. One day, there was a book that came out. It was Bob Hope.
Bob Hope. Mm-hmm. That's right.
One day, there was a book came out called The Road to Christmas. I forget what it was. It was a book he wrote about his Vietnam trips. And he was appearing at the May Company near me, signed them. And I thought, well, I would like to go up and, you know, get a signed book from Bob Hope and maybe say hello to him. But I don't want to wait in line for 3 hours. Well, the day that it happened, it was pouring rain. It was a deluge. And then it ended about 10 minutes before the signing. The rain just stopped. And I thought, oh boy, nobody will show up now. So I ran up there, I put on my raincoat, I ran up to make, I walked up to it, it was not far from our house. And I get to the place, and I look, and the line is about 3 hours long. Anyway, so I thought, well, I'm not going to bother with this. I'm sorry. So I go down to the basement where they were selling art supplies. They had an art supply to pick up something. And I'm standing in the basement in my raincoat dripping still. And the elevator opens, and Bob Hope and an entourage walk in. That's where they were bringing him in. That was the access from the garage. And he walks in, and he sees me standing there dripping, and he said, I don't understand how he had just arrived and wasn't aware that it had been raining outside. I think he was napping in the car, something like that. And he says, and I'm leaving out part of the story here, because on the way there, walking to the May Company, I started kind of like mentally thinking, what will Bob Hope say? What will he do? And at that time, Mark Spitz was the big laugh line in jokes. Mark Spitz, the Olympic swimmer.
Sure.
So I thought, I said... I kind of mentally just wrote, just this is the kind of thing I used to do as a kid. I kind of mentally wrote jokes that Bob Hope might do for just my own amusement. And one of them was, I wouldn't say it's wet outside, but on the escalator up here, I passed three halibut and Mark Spitz.
Nice.
So I'm standing in the art supply department at the May Company, and Bob Hope walks up and says, how you doing? Doing, pal. And he says, it looks like it's wet outside. And I said, are you kidding? On the escalator, I passed three halibut and Mark Spitz. And he laughed and said, that's a good one. So they let him off. He had about eight people with him. They let him off to the signing upstairs. I thought, well, I got to go up and see what's going on there. I ran and I ran up and I took the escalator up. He was taking a different elevator up. And I got there before him so I could watch him arrive and watch the audience, the people in line just break into applause. He gets to the front of the line, picks up a microphone, and he says, everybody, hey, I want to thank you all for coming out here. I wouldn't say it's what I say, but on the escalator up here, I passed three halibut and Mark Spitz.
Oh, wow.
And I kind of, like, my jaw caromed off the flooring. So I had to get in line. Yeah. I had to go say something to him. So I got on the line, and I waited about 2 hours, 2.5 hours, whatever it was, just to say hello to him and to say, you know, hey, you used my joke. And he went, thanks, kid, you know, and it was... And I just kind of went home shaking, thinking to myself. Now, at this point, I was not a professional comedy writer. Years later, I was writing for people like Bob. I wrote for Bob Hope on a show later. Oh, but wow. At that time, when I would tell my friends, I wrote a joke that Bob Hope said, they went, yeah, right, okay, sure. So I didn't tell the story to too many people because they didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm. I know this story, but nobody else... I mean, I don't know how many people do, but it's really interesting. How did you decide that you wanted to be a TV writer? At what point was it?
Well, I decided when I was a kid I wanted to be a writer.
Okay.
I wasn't sure what kind of writer. When I was a kid, I started writing. In kindergarten, I started writing. When they would pass out construction paper and crayons that you were supposed to just draw on, I wrote a book.
Awesome.
My mother still has it. It was a blatant plagiarism from Dr. Seuss.
But, okay.
You know, people have made very good living stealing from Dr. Seuss.
Indeed.
Oh, yeah.
I got all this fuss, like, oh, your son can write at a very early age. He's a writer. So I said, okay, I'll be a writer. So I wanted to write TV shows at one moment. One week I wanted to write TV shows. One week I wanted to write comic books. One week I wanted to write cartoons. Eventually I got to do all these things.
Yeah.
When I was about... 10 years old or 11 years old one day, my parents, my Aunt Dot was flying to Las Vegas. My father loved to drive people to the airport. My father was a lovely man, but he was very stingy about certain things.
Okay.
He was very generous with me, but Jewish guys who grew up in the Depression believed you don't call long distance, you don't pay retail, and you don't take a taxi.
Okay.
So yeah. He would drive you to the airport. He'd drive anybody to the airport. My father was the original super shuttle.
That's really funny.
We went to the airport, and we ran into Maury Amsterdam there. He was on the same flight as my aunt.
Wow.
And she started talking to him in the waiting room, waiting to get on the flight. And she told him the Dick Van Dyke Show, which was on the air at the time, was her favorite show. And I thought to myself, well, okay. Dick Van Dyke Show's my favorite. I went to Maury Amsterdam. This is before Groucho.
Yeah.
But Maury Amsterdam wasn't that you know, he was a great TV star, but he wasn't that impressive, like Groucho.
Right.
Yeah.
So I said to him, the Dick Van Dyke Show is my favorite TV show. And he said, yeah, you want to come see us, watch us film an episode? And I said, yeah, don't you have to be like 16 to get in? And he said, well, you look like a nice kid and I'll vouch for you. So he pulled out a business card for something else. It wasn't even his own business card. It was just what he had in the pocket.
Oh my God.
He wrote a phone number on the back of it. And he said, call this number tomorrow and tell them you're my personal guest and I want you to come to a filming and I'll show you around and everything.
Wow.
So I went, hamana.
Yeah.
So we called up and my parents and I took me to an episode filming of the Dick Van Dyke Show a couple weeks later. Which, of course, as irony would have it, was an episode that did not have Maury Amsterdam in it.
Oh, no.
But, what episode was it?
It was the one about Rob and Laura buying their house and there's a rock in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
It had Dick Van Dyke, Mary Tyler Moore, Jerry Paris, and Anne Morgan Gilbert, but it did not have Rose Marie, Maury Amsterdam, or Larry Matthews, or Richard Deacon.
Okay. Oh.
So, I just sat there watching that film, and I had seen TV shows filmed before. I went to see Concentration done live in New York when I was a couple of years earlier. I went to see, I'm not sure it was before or after, I went to see the Red Skelton show done. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, the Dick Van Dyke Show, which was such a wonderful show to me, it was just a magical evening. Carl Reiner was the MC that night. Usually Rose Marie and Maury Amsterdam did the warm-up, but they weren't there, so Carl Reiner did it. Mel Brooks was in the audience, and he and Carl were yelling at each other the whole time.
Of course.
Oh, my gosh.
Mr. Reiner was so funny, the show almost couldn't follow. It was like, oh, we got to stop Carl talking and do the show now. And there were many images that evening, but two of them, one was that there were two guys standing around who I later realized were Sam Persky and Bill Denoff, two of the writers. Two guys with sweaters standing around there. And I never wanted to be a performer, but these guys were important on the set. They belonged there. I thought, that's what I want to be. I want to do that with that, whatever those guys are. You know. And I figured they were writers.
Mm-hmm.
The other mental image is that Mary Tyler Moore was there. And this was the first time I'd ever seen Mary Tyler Moore in color. And not only in person and in color. And she was the best looking thing I had ever seen in my life. She was so fabulous. I mean, they had her made up and her hair was perfect. And you could just stare at her. And I went, oh, I want to be here because I want to be around people like that.
There's a story that I heard Rob Reiner tell. Do you know the story?
Yes.
Yes. And in fact, you probably told it to me.
I may have. I sat next to Rob Reiner at a film festival one time. And I turned to him and I said, excuse me, Mr. Reiner, could I ask you a question? And he said, yes, sure. And I said, there's a story about you and Mary Tyler Moore. He said, yes, I did. And yes, it was wonderful.
Okay, that's the story.
Yeah, it was about him grabbing Mary Tyler Moore on the rear end.
When he
was a kid.
Wow. I believe in the bright, shiny capri pants he used to wear.
There are many reasons to envy Rob Reiner. You know, this is Spinal Tap and all these wonderful movies and
all
things like that. But you know... He grabbed Mary Tyler Moore on the ass, and so that's
that's enough.
That's enough.
I think he was young enough to still get away with it. Like, was he a teenager or something like that?
I think
that?
He was about my age, I think, probably. Or maybe a little younger, maybe a little older than me, but I was about 10 or 12 when that show was on, so he was probably about 14 or 15.
Oh, wow.
Which is a good age to grab Mary Tyler Moore by the ass.
Yeah, it's old enough to know what you're doing, too.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
What was your first memory of the Marx Brothers? What was the first time you saw them or the first movie you went to see?
Well, I probably knew Groucho from the TV game show first.
Oh.
But I think probably the first movie, Marx Brothers movie, I'm going to guess Horse Feathers for some reason. I don't know why. I do remember in 1970, there was a science fiction convention, or maybe it was 71, in Long Beach. And my friend Rob Solomon and I went there. And we went to see a double feature of Night of the Opera and Day at the Races at a place called the New State Theater in Long Beach, which we later found out was the theater where those two movies had previewed originally.
Oh, wow.
And we saw them in this old movie theater in a place that was packed with people who loved the movie, and it probably was identical to seeing those movies when they first came out.
That is awesome.
Yeah, I remember that. That evening, I remember that's when I really fell in love with the Marx Brothers. Was that movie? Seeing those.
That's a perfect location to see
it. Double feature, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had sort of known who Groucho was again through the TV show, actually through a parody they did of him on Beanie and Cecil. I think they did a like a phantom parody where they kind of imitated his voice or something. And I said, "Who's that?" My dad said, "I think that's supposed to be Groucho Marx." And I said, "Who's that?" He goes, "The TV guy, the quiz guy." And then years later, when I went to boarding school, they used to show movies, and they rented The Big Store, which is not their best effort, but...
That was a great movie, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's got some great stuff in it.
Lucy Ball in it, and...
No, that's Room Service.
Oh, Room Service, sorry.
The Big Store there, Groucho's a detective at a department store, and it's very Three Stooges-like, especially at the end, there's a big chase and everything. But I just remember wanting to see them again, and there was like a little movie theater in Monterey that if you wrote in, you know, it was like a hippie movie theater. They had a sheet that you would sign in on. What do you want us to rent next? And I said, Marx Brothers. And within 2 months, they brought in Duck Soup. And I thought, oh my God.
Okay. So we know why you wanted to become a TV writer. What was was TV where you started?
Well, I started writing comic books when I was 17.
What was the first comic book?
Well, let's see. Actually, I started when I was, I graduated from high school when I was 17. And
that's young.
The first, well, I skipped grades. Oh. I actually skipped a couple. I actually missed a year because I had scarlet fever when I was a kid.
Ooh.
And then I skipped 2 years after that.
So oh my God.
Very, very strange. But
that's awesome.
About 2 weeks after I got out of high school, I decided, okay, it's time to start my professional writing career.
Of course, because that's normal for a 17-year-old to do.
Went to the newsstand, and for some reason I thought magazines published in Los Angeles. I wanted to find a magazine. I didn't want to submit by mail. I wanted the experience of actually like handing something to an editor and having a relationship.
Hmm.
And at that time, they were publishing a magazine called Laugh-In Magazine based on the TV show. It was kind of a low-rent version of Mad Magazine. It was published in Hollywood. Hmm. I found it. I bought a couple copies. I wrote a couple of articles that would fit it. I took the bus to Hollywood. I didn't drive at the time, and I went up to the office of the publisher, and I said to the secretary, I'm a struggling young comedy writer, I'd like to meet the editor. And she said, just a minute, and she buzzed the editor and said, we have a struggling young comedy writer out here who would like to see you. And he said, apparently, tell him if he comes back in an hour, I'll give him all the time he needs.
Wow.
So I went away, came back in an hour, and I took my 6 articles into the editor. He bought 3 of them.
Wow.
And I went home with a check for $900.
Oh, wow. My gosh.
My father was making $380 a week at the time. So,
oh, wow.
And so that was the first thing I did. A week later, I met Jack Kirby. And on his recommendation, I got a job working for the company that was handling the merchandising of Marvel Comics locally. They were selling posters and... It was a crooked operation, it turned out, but for a while I worked for this company that was doing posters and magazines and decals of Marvel heroes. They needed somebody on the staff who had heard of the characters.
Oh.
And that was me. And
so what was your job there? What were you?
I was the editor of the fan magazine. I was the expert on Marvel. They'd come to me and say, what's this character? And I'd say, that's Dr. Doom. They go, oh, thank you.
Oh, my God.
Now, would Jack do original art for them?
Jack had done a bunch of things for them, a lot of original art for them, for which he was never paid.
Oh, wow.
You know, to Jack Kirby getting stiff. How often did that happen? Anyway, but the that led to me writing for Disney Comics. I had this friend of mine I knew named Mike Royer, who was an artist,
mm-hmm.
was working for comics. And Mike, I recommended Mike for some jobs, so he recommended me to write for this job writing Disney Comics. And I started UCLA in the fall of 69. And I was sitting in my economics class at UCLA writing Donald Duck stories in the back of the class when nobody was looking.
Uh-huh.
And that led to me writing the American... The ones I was writing were for Europe originally, and then that led to me writing the ones for America. And by 1972, I think I was writing 8 comic books a month.
Oh, my gosh.
I was writing Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, The Roadrunner, Scooby-Doo, Woody Woodpecker.
Those were all the Gold Key ones?
Yeah, yeah. A whole bunch of those things. Super Goof, The Beagle Boys. Yeah.
Wow.
I was still writing stuff for the foreign market and such. I'd write a story for the American market. And if the editor there didn't like it, I'd just take it and sell it to the people who bought the European stories.
Mm-hmm.
So. I remember reading some of those comics and thinking they were really good. Like the writing on them was pretty sharp.
Those weren't mine then.
No, I think I mentioned it to you that there was one that I thought that was really... good. It was the Tasmanian Devil running for mayor or something.
I had the Tasmanian Devil run for mayor.
Yeah, he
is now, by the way, the leading Republican nominee.
this moment. Well, I heard he was in some trouble down in Bell.
So.
There is that.
Yeah.
So you went right now. How did you manage your time at that young age? How old were you at the time you were writing the Gold Key comics?
20.
Okay. How on earth did you manage your time to become that prolific?
Well, that's one of the things I did get from Jack. I said earlier I didn't get anything from Jack Kirby. I did. I saw his work ethic, and I learned.
Oh, wow.
Jack was very, you know, people used to always say, you know, Jack in his lifetime wrote and drew thousands and thousands of pages of comics. And people used to always say, boy, he's fast. He's the fastest artist who ever lived. And it's true, he was fast. But his lifetime output was also a function of being willing to sit at the drawing table for 18 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Wow.
A lot of people just can't or won't do that.
Right.
Sometimes won't is more operative than can't. So I just learned you got the job, you got to do it. And also, I also discovered early on that the more you did, the better it came out in terms of you got more power with the company, you got more control, you became more valuable to them. So when I started writing for Gold Key Comics, the editor there told me I could have as much work as I wanted. And I said, I'll take as much as I can do. And I ended up doing all these different comics for them to the point where when I walked in and said, I want you to change this, the cover's wrong, or I don't like the way this is drawn, they listened to me because I was an integral part of the company by then.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for a couple of years. And then I segued into other comic books. And then I segued into writing jokes for stand-up comedians. And I went from that to writing live-action television. I went from that to writing animation. But I always stayed in comic books whenever I could. It was only a few periods ever in my life I wasn't writing a comic book somewhere.
Wow.
So.
And now you've got a comic book that you created with Sergio Aragonés called Gru.
Well, to be technical, Sergio created Gru, and then he brought me in to be his collaborator, mm-hmm. partner in crime, accomplice. I don't know what I do in that book, but I have created a few comics with other people and with Sergio as well.
And what else?
I did a comic book for a number of years called The DNA Agents with Will Mineo. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then that had a spinoff called Crossfire with Dan Spiegel.
Love that. Yeah, that was really
and
great.
And I did, I did a book called, well, Sergio and I did a book called, we did a book called Fanboy for DC. Fanboy was really neat because, you know how they print the total, they have these things called the Statement of Ownership. They print the circulation. We were able with Fanboy to print just a list of the names of everybody who bought the comic. There were about 35 people, I think.
Oh, come on.
It was actually a comic. I knew I was in trouble when I was at the DC offices one day, and one of the editors up there came up to me. He says, "Oh, Mark, what are you should be doing some stuff. We gotta get you doing stuff for DC." I said, "Well, I'm doing this comic called Fanboy." He says, "Oh, really? I told him about it. He'd never heard of it before.
Oh,
and I said, "Oh, geez, when is that coming out?" I said, "Well, number 5 just came out."
Oh, that's not good.
You know,
that's not uncommon.
Yeah, it sounds like Tower of Rip, doesn't it?
So, well, it sounds like a lot of things. Yes,
but I did a book with Sergio called Boogeyman. I did a book for him called Magnor.
Space Circus.
Yeah, I love doing Space Circus. Yeah, that was my favorite thing I think I've done with Sergio.
That's great.
Did you do the Day of the Dead one, De
Los
Muertos?
We did one shot called Day of the Dead, yeah.
Yeah,
we just do all really sorts nice. Of silly stuff. Right now we're doing a Gru meets Conan crossover.
Awesome. And I'm assuming this is Conan the Barbarian, not Conan O'Brien.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
Right, okay.
Although, that's not a bad... No, that's not a bad...
See, that's why I brought you over here. I wanted to pitch that to you. Oh, that's okay. The only reason.
Oh, I see a great backup feature.
So,
for Frodo and Andy.
When is that coming out?
I have no idea.
Okay.
We've got the second issue done, and Sergio is drawing the third one, and we'll schedule it whenever we get around to finishing it.
Now, you've had an amazing career also in television, and I mean, you kind of like glossed over, and then live-action television, and then... Live-action television and then? Can you expand that just a little
bit, please? Well, I started writing jokes for stand-up comedians about 74, 75.
Any names everybody would recognize?
Freddie Prinze, mm-hmm. Bill Kirkenbauer, mm-hmm. Steve Landisberg, mm-hmm. Gabe Kaplan, some people who never went on to anything. just different comedians I knew. I just give guys one or two jokes.
Sure.
Did you get approached for that, or did you approach people? Saying, well, hey, you know, I got stuff.
What happened was, I started hanging out at the Comedy Store. There was a golden era at the Comedy Store. This was the mid-70s. You'd go there for an evening, and there'd be the guys I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. There'd be Willie Tyler and Lester. Rodney Dangerfield might drop in. Richard Pryor might drop in.
Oh, wow.
There was this guy with a little later on, there was this guy with a red beard named David Letterman, who was an MC there.
Who's that?
Yeah, Jane. No name.
One time, this guy comes up to me, who works at the Comedy Store. He said, Mitzi Shore is the lady who owns mm-hmm. the Comedy Store.
Right.
This guy comes up to me and says, Mitzi's car won't start. And I said, okay. He said, well, you can fix it, can't you? I said, no. He said, no, come on, you can fix it. She wants you to fix her car.
What?
And I went, I don't fix cars. I mean, I don't know how to fix it. He says, no, it's take a look under the hood. And I go, I wouldn't know what I'm looking at. And I realized the guy thought I was Jay Leno.
Oh, my.
Oh, my.
What?
We looked a little bit alike at the time.
I mean,
chin isn't nearly
as big. Yeah, my chin wasn't as big, but the guy just thought I was, you know, he was so confused. He thought I was this Leno guy who hung around.
Also, who's that guy?
Yeah. And I wrote some stuff for Jay later on.
Mm-hmm.
But what would happen would be, at that time, writing for stand-up comedians is the worst job in the world. It doesn't pay very well. And most of them are, the guys you're dealing with are starting out, so they're broke. And they don't want to pay. And if they promise to pay, they don't pay.
Oh.
And you're sitting there haggling with somebody over $5 here or $10 here. So I did something which at the time people thought was stupid, but I, in hindsight, realized it was one of the smartest things I could have done, which was I started writing for free. I just went to, I had approached a few comedians and said, hey, I got some stuff. And I didn't like that. I didn't like selling my own stuff. I didn't like haggling with them. I didn't like sitting there in the back of the store with them reading this stuff and saying, oh, I don't think this will work and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I just said, look, here's the deal. You can have it if you use it. If you don't, if it's part of your act, if you're using it regularly, it's yours. If not, I get it back.
That's pretty
and all fair. Of a sudden, comedians are seeking me out. I'm the guy who writes jokes for nothing. Well, I could do that at the time because I was writing comic books. I was writing the Tarzan foreign comics department for Edgar Rice Burroughs, so I was making plenty of money doing comics. I was living at home still at the time.
Wow.
So I didn't need the money, and I didn't need the $200 I might have made a week doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was that all these comedians owed me favors. One of the guys used to pay me in blank videotapes because he was working. His regular job was working at a tape place.
Sure.
This was back before Beta. This was when there were 3/4-inch videotapes.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Which cost a lot of money, and he would pay me for jokes in tapes, which was terrific. And so that led to me starting to write TV shows because I made all these connections through that. And I met a fellow named Dennis Palumbo, who was an aspiring guy writing for stand-ups, the same as me. We were on the same level. And at that time, comedy writers came in pairs. You know, if you met one young comedy writer, you said, where's your partner? Automatically, because they always were in teams, and Dennis felt he needed a partner. So we teamed up, and we started selling stuff. We started selling scripts to TV shows. And we wound up going on staff on Welcome Back, Cotter. And we wound up writing pilots for other shows. And then we did that for 2 years. And then we split up amicably. We stayed friends. And I went off and started writing variety shows and other things. And I started writing cartoon shows about then, too.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Have you ever had any desire to, at that age, to be a stand-up yourself?
No.
I don't blame you.
No. Finally, that was one of the weird things. When I was writing stand-up jokes for stand-ups, they kind of presumed you had a stand-up act. So Jimmy Walker one time looked at a bunch of my jokes and he said, "Hey, I want a couple of these things. Tell you what, I'll get your stand-up act booked someplace. In other words, instead of paying you, I'll get your stand-up act booked." And I said, "Well, I don't have a stand-up act." And he went like, "What? What are you doing here?" it was so bizarre that someone didn't want to go on stage and do stand-up, but I just, you know, never felt that it was something I should do or wanted to do or would enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Just to digress for a second, I went to college with three guys who Dennis Leary, Mario Cantone, and Eddie Brill, who's now the warm-up guy for Letterman. And I would go and see them in Boston clubs because we all went to the same school. And I would walk in and I'd go, man, I don't want to do this ever. You know, I mean, I love comedy. I love writing comedy, but I would see what they go through for an open mic night, and I would go like, oh, man, I can never imagine doing this.
Yeah, in high school, I was not class clown. I was the guy who used to write for class clown.
There you go.
And, it's a better deal.
Yeah, I just, you know, I think, you know, I went to my high school reunion, and I went to my 10-year reunion and my 25-year reunion, and in both cases, I saw all these guys I'd gone to school with who were still trying to figure out what to do with their lives. Mm-hmm. They were still kind of like wandering around. They didn't have a profession. They was like taking odd jobs. And I thought to myself, gee, I'm so lucky. I figured out early what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. and I've stuck with it. And so I never, and when I've been offered chances to perform in some way, I generally turned them down. I got stuck in doing a sketch on one of the variety shows I did for the Crofts. I got stuck being in it one time accidentally. And I, you know how the people
how do
say
get stuck accidentally well, being in a Croft. I mean, don't you have to get fitted for mascot costumes and stuff like that? Yeah. How does that happen?
What happened was, I was the head writer on this show.
Okay, what show is
this? This was Pink Lady.
Okay,
Pink Lady right. show. Mm-hmm. I was the head writer, and all the writers kept wanting to be in the sketches.
Okay.
And I didn't want this to happen because number one, we had shows to write. I didn't want everybody to be on stage or in costumes or makeups. Number two, I had seen when I was doing Cotter. We were sharing office space with another variety show. It was Captain and Tennille's show. Mm-hmm. And I remember one moment. It was a very strange moment. Don Knotts was the guest star on the Captain and Tennille's show. And I knew Don Knotts. I had met Don Knotts. And I went over to say hello to him. And he was very upset. He'd come in, and they just read through the script. And he had no funny lines. The writers had them all.
Oh.
And these writers had put themselves into sketches and they'd given themselves all the funny lines. And Don Knotts was kind of mystified. He kept saying, he wasn't being egotistical about this. He wasn't being angry. He was just kind of like,
what am I doing here?
Yeah. Why do they have me here if these unknown people in the sketches are getting all the funny lines?
Absolutely.
Yeah, really.
So when
I started writing
question.
Variety shows, I made a rule when I was a head writer at least, no writers in sketches. Well, one day we had a sketch that needed a bunch of male extras. It was a roast. It was a roast sketch of Abraham Lincoln. We were parodying the Dean Martin roast. We had Red Buttons playing John Wilkes Booth.
Awesome.
he didn't get a dinner thing. And we needed a bunch of guys to be in the sketches, to be like extras and play little bit parts. And the writers came to me en masse and said, please let us be in the sketch. Please let us be in the sketch. So I said, okay. On one condition, which is nobody goes to wardrobe or makeup until the last minute. We got to write that day. We've got to write the next week's show. You guys, you know, if the call time is 5:00, you go down there at 4:45. You don't.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they said fine. So I said okay. The writers will be the extras in there, forgetting that phrase included me.
Oh no.
So that day. First of all the writers were in makeup by 10 a.m.
Of course.
Oh, geez.
They all went down. Nothing got written that day. Everybody was down on the stage. They got into makeup and costume 6-10 hours before they were needed. And hanging out and being actors and stuff like that. And then they called me and they said, Mark, you haven't come down to be fitted for your costume. And I went, I'm not in the sketch. They said, yes, we rented you a costume. You've got to come down and we've rented the costume. And I went, uh-oh. So I went down at the last minute. Mm-hmm. I went down to the stage, and everybody's saying, why aren't you in your costume? I said, because I'm not getting into the damn costume and makeup until the last minute. Mm-hmm. You've been in it for 9 hours. And I ended up being in the sketch. And the punchline of this is, you know, there's this moment that most actors say, when they step foot on a stage, they go, this is where I belong. Mm-hmm. I belong in front of an audience. I belong in front of a camera. I set foot on that stage and I said, I shouldn't be here. I should be in the booth watching this. This is so, and I felt so wrong.
Wow.
Every minute I was there, I said, let me get out of this. And I couldn't wait to get out of the costume and get off the set. And I've avoided that ever since. And I'm a happier person for it.
And yet I have never known a more avid supporter of the arts.
Well, fine. You can support the arts without doing it.
Yes,
you know?
That's true.
I love jugglers. I did That's Incredible for 3 years. We had on jugglers and magicians and acrobats.
Okay,
and
stop
for
a second and tell them who your favorite magician is that you had on That's Incredible and why. Okay, well, one of your favorites anyway. We're always talking about going to see him at the castle.
Cutterbucks?
No. His name is Richard Turner.
Richard Turner. Oh, yes. Yeah. I was at Magic Castle one day. I took a bunch of comic book writers up to Magic Castle one night. And we had this guy who came out and did card tricks who was blind. And everybody in our group had written the Daredevil comic book. And we suddenly realized we found Daredevil. He's doing it by touch.
Yeah.
He's a superhero doing it. So I put him on That's Incredible the next week. I'm all of Misty Lee.
Who
gives all these things that I not only can't do, I would never even try to do because I know I could never do them as
Me
well
neither.
As
absolutely.
I used to draw. When I was a kid, I drew a lot.
And you draw very well, by the way. I have a McKimson-style Bugs Bunny that you drew for me at dinner one evening and then promptly signed. I think you signed it Tex Avery.
I signed it Tex Avery.
Yes, thank you.
I would have put my name on that piece of crap.
I asked him to sign it, and he signs it Tex Avery.
Well, you know, but I used to share an office with Tex. I can do his signature.
Yeah.
But
quite well,
The thing is that I realized when I got into comics, I was a writer and I was a little bit of an artist. I realized I'm hanging around with Jack Kirby, I'm hanging around with Sergio Aragonés, I'm hanging around with Scott Shaw and Dan Spiegel and Will Mineo and people like that. And I realized I can never be the best artist in the room. I don't have the skill. No. I could maybe in certain companies be the best writer in the room.
Okay.
Like I am now. But I said it for a cheap laugh.
Paul, that knife in your lung, I can use that to cut the pizza.
Why be last place?
Yeah.
So I kind of
when
gave
you know
up
where
drawing
you're first, yeah.
because I just realized, and I enjoy writing more anyway. There's no point in drawing. So I've given up too much drawing. I've got to go back. I'm so far out of practice. I did a chalk talk at a kid's school, an elementary school.
What's a chalk talk?
Just getting up and telling the kids about cartoons.
That's
teaching
cool.
Teaching kids how to draw Garfield. Teaching kids. And I I better practice for the next one of these.
Yeah.
I'm way out of practice. The kids are kind of go, I'm saying, and there we are. That's how you draw Scooby-Doo. And they go, is that really Scooby-Doo? I go, oh, yeah, it's Scooby-Doo, yeah.
Looks a lot like Captain Carrot,
that's
but
right,
you don't
yes.
draw.
No, but anyway, I wandered far afield from the question you asked me.
Oh, but you answered the question. It was about Richard Turner.
Yeah, Richard Turner.
And I was talking about you being such an avid supporter of the arts. You are
a huge, I'll tell you the story. I don't know if I ever told you the story.
Okay.
That I thought you were alluding to. I went up to the castle one night. I was with a lady friend of mine named Sherry Flanagan, who drew for the National Lampoon.
Wonderful cartoonist.
We go up one night, and we're going, and somebody said to us at the castle, one of the hosts, it was in one of those nights, the place was empty. It was a Monday night, and somebody said, are you staying around for the special show? And I said, what's the special show? They said, well, Kuda Bucks is performing. Now, I knew who Kuda Bucks was. It's KUDABUX. Kuda Bucks was a TV star in the 50s in television. He was billed as the man with X-ray eyes. His act was that they would take 20 minutes to cover, to blindfold him. They'd put coins over his eyes. They'd put dough over his eyes. They'd wrap his head up. They'd put 35 layers of stuff on his head.
Wow.
And then he'd drive a car, or he would do other things that meant he was sighted.
Sure.
He was retired. He retired in the early 60s. This is 1981. He has come out of retirement for one night to do a show for other Magic Castle members.
Mm.
So we go to this show, and it was in the parlor of Prestidigitation. I was the only person in the room besides Sherry who wasn't an accomplished professional magician. They were all there. Every name in Magic there to see Kuda Bucks do his act, because none of them had ever seen him live. He comes out, he does his act. It is amazing. He also did another trick that he had invented while in retirement, a trick unrelated to sight. And he did this other trick, and I saw that bizarre look you occasionally will know from magicians, where you see a very accomplished magician, somebody who's done magic his whole life, go, I don't know how he did that. It's a very wonderful thing to fool other magicians like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, but after Kuda Bucks had done his X-ray eyes trick, I went up to him, he was being mobbed afterwards, and I said, Mr. Bucks, have you ever done that? When was the last time you did that act on television? He said, 1963. And I said, have you ever done it on color TV? He said, I don't think so. I said, would you like to do it on TV? And he said, well, yes, I would love to someplace, but who's going to let me do it on television? my grandchildren have never seen me perform, you know. And I said, well, I am one of the writer, head writer of That's Incredible. How would you like to come in and do the show on ABC? You know, we're number one. We're in the top 10. This is,
yeah.
And he said, oh, my God, yes, yes, I would love to do that. And I called the producer. I made a phone call. I called the producer. He said, on your say-so, we'll book him. And we were going to book him. And he was so excited. This was on a Monday night. We were going to tape him that Friday because he was in town or whatever. Anyway, Tuesday, they couldn't reach him on the phone. Wednesday, they couldn't reach him on the phone. Thursday, we had to cancel him out because we couldn't reach him. Friday, Variety had his obit.
Oh, God.
He died Tuesday night.
You killed Kuda Bucks.
I killed Kuda Bucks, yes.
With excitement.
That's right.
Wow. Oh, that's incredible.
That's right. Oh.
that whole so, thing.
That's yeah. just, when you're indicating blind, that's what I thought yeah, you were referring to.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Oh, I don't think I've ever heard that story.
Oh, yes.
That's a good one. No, I don't know if you guys at home know, but Mark is huge, huge, hugely knowledgeable about magic. So much so that he is an historian member of the Magic Castle, one of very few, I might add. And being a Magic Castle magician member, I know how difficult it is to attain that status. And Mark went in and they questioned him. Actually, they grilled him.
Yes.
And he had to prove a very deep level, and he had to impress the magicians that were grilling him with his knowledge of magic.
Well, actually, I told them what had happened to Kuda Bucks. I said, now, if you cross me,
yeah, there you go.
You're in big trouble.
Now, knowledge of magicians or magic in general?
Yes, both. To both.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
and so can you actually perform magic if you wanted to?
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. yeah, but I don't do it because, yeah. like, why would I perform it in a room with Misty?
Yeah, of course.
I'm not going to be the best magician in the room.
But you could.
I have no chance of
it. But you could accomplish
it. You don't know
it.
That, Mark.
Get through it.
I've done tricks for, you know, I do card tricks for people occasionally. Mm-hmm.
Just that's great.
Silly things.
He's got really good ones, too. He does close-up stuff. He won't show them to me, of course, but I hear that they're legendary.
Actually, you know, they're really great. You know,
yeah,
I'll go over
I'm not surprised.
First thing is like, hey, here, let me show you a card trick.
Yeah, yeah, which is something you never get at home. I never do that to you, ever.
Yeah, but
I really don't.
But you see, I wouldn't try to tell jokes to Groucho. I wouldn't try to do a magic trick for Misty Lee.
Yeah.
I love magic tricks, though, especially good ones. And like I said, I've seen so many bad card tricks, it would be a breath of fresh air, I have to say. But you also wrote a comic book of the spirit. And peppered it with magicians. You and Sergio
I
did.
Stuck a bunch of magicians, one of whom is in this room.
Yes, indeed. Paul Dini.
That's right.
No, it's the amazing Muggsy.
Yeah, yes. we Sergio and I did 12 issues of the Spirit comic, which he actually kind of wrote and I kind of just did the dialogue for. But that's...
Everybody was peppered throughout there. It was like a who's who.
Yeah, well, I mentioned my favorite magicians, current magicians, in the book, and they got all impressed.
Yeah, well, everybody loved it. Johnny Ace Palmer, Whit Hayden, everybody's got that as a collectible. That's a huge moment in a magician's life to be mentioned in a comic book and not know you were going to be. That's huge. Now, who are your favorite magicians? I know you liked Kuda Bucks. I know you like Charlie Fry, who's a juggler.
Charlie Fry is a juggler who's brilliant. I love those people. I love when I did That's Incredible. I got to hang around with jugglers and magicians and people like that. My favorite magicians. I'll tell you. I worked with a great magician who's now passed away named Don Allen.
Yeah,
who was one of the cleverest, funniest close-up guys who ever lived. And I got to hang out with Di Vernon at the castle.
Oh my
a lot
gosh, I'm so jealous
like
of you.
But of people performing, say Whit Hayden, Lance. I used to date a girl who was in Lance Burton's act. I'd go to. When he was at the Hacienda.
Okay, which, by the way, just so you guys at home know, means she was smoking hot.
Well,
because Lance does not hire... Well, Deuce doesn't think so. But Lance does not fool around when he hires female assistants.
Yeah, well...
I'm just saying that.
Well, anyway, so
but very modest, Mark. But I think that it bears a mention.
All right, well, okay. Anyway, but she was one of his dancers and people. And I got to, I saw Lance Burton when he was at the Hacienda. I saw his act about 80 times.
Oh wow!
And got to appreciate how really good he is. David Copper. I went to see David Copperfield recently. I may do a project with him. And, oh, and that's cool. He's really as good as his. He lives up to his reputation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you get in his warehouse at all?
I got an invitation to go to his warehouse. Yeah. I haven't taken him up on it yet.
Someone was telling us, and I'm not going to say who, but someone was telling us that they were walking around there the other day. Well, not the other day. A couple weeks ago, I'd say. Uh-huh. And looking at how he's got this very private warehouse with all of this really remarkable memorabilia from not only Magic, but also some movies. Huh. And ironically enough, he has the crates from Citizen Kane. Huh. Down there.
Wow.
Stored where no one can see them. And the irony was not lost on the guest in the warehouse
That's good irony.
Yeah. So anyway,
the magicians, I like Richard Turner. I like Whit Hayden, the guys you mentioned. I like...
You like Johnny Ace Palmer a lot, too.
I used to like watching the Pendragons. Just people like that. Yeah, and I also love sometimes those wonderful discoveries you make at the castle where some people you never heard of before... Who came over from Sweden suddenly, and there's somebody there doing something nobody's ever done before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really nice. And the castle, for those of you that don't know, the castle is a really unique club. And Mark and Paul are actually the very first time I ever ate dinner there. It was with you and with Paul.
Yeah.
We were all there together long before I had even auditioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I told you the story of how I became a member, didn't I?
No.
No.
Well, I was dating this girl who was a dancer on the Croft shows. Her name was Bridget.
Okay.
And she was... a dancer in the a lot of the variety shows we did.
Is this Corset Bridget? What? Is that the girl with the corset?
Yes, this is the one who had the corset. Anyway. Mm-hmm. And one day she was working as an assistant to Chuck Jones, the magician.
The magician, not the cartoonist.
Not the magician.
Right.
And she said, "You want to come up and see me be sawed in half?" And I, you know, I thought, "Oh, okay, I'll get the half that eats."
Yeah. But
you know, awesome. I gotta pay Henning Youngman a royalty for that. So she had me come up to the castle to see her, and I thought, gee, I've got to belong to this place.
Oh.
And I fell in love with the castle and joined the next day. Oh. And I owe that to her.
Mm. What a great story.
Yeah.
I mean, so here's this guy, and not only he started in comic books, moved on, did a little bit of live action in his words because he's so modest. Then he also dabbles in magic. Mm-hmm. No, do you have any free time? Ever?
Free time. I've heard of that.
Wow,
I've
dude.
Heard of that. Actually, that was one of our Twitter questions. I put it out there on Twitter to see if somebody had questions for tonight.
Questions from the fans.
One of the questions we had for Mark was from TV Colin Campbell, who says, "When does he sleep? The man is a 24-hour content creating machine."
Okay. Well, I sleep 4 hours a night, usually from 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. But I need more. No, it gets back to what I was saying earlier about I learned Jack Kirby's work ethics from him, mm-hmm. and I picked them up and I've applied them. And Jack worked those kind of hours, and so you just do it.
Wow.
Can I ask you a couple more questions?
Sure. You ask me anything you want.
From our good friend Ken Plume, he would like to find out more about the.
They're coming out. It's coming out. It's coming out.
Pogo collection. Yes. All right. Okay. All right.
What is it? The Pogo thing?
Yes.
Yes. I go from here to pick Carol, my friend Carolyn, up to work on the Pogo collection.
Okay. Oh, beautiful.
Because he has to work some more after he's left the podcast. Yeah.
That's right. Yes.
Let's see.
Yeah, because you do absolutely nothing all day.
I do.
That's right.
I didn't do anything today.
Uh-oh. Surabin wants to know, how are the cats?
Cats are fine.
There we go.
I fed them just before I left. I have four feral cats I feed in my backyard. Mm-hmm. I have Max the bulimic pussycat and the stranger cat and Lydia, who I had to trap and take in for a kitty abortion one time.
Is she tattooed?
No. Well, she's a calico, so she's kind of...
Perfect.
Yeah. We used to call her just she was a stray, and I trapped her in a trap. I took her into this vet who specializes in doing feral cats cheap. He does. Mm. He fixes them. And I took them in. I took them in, and they said, "Okay, what's her name?" And I went, So I go, "Well, call her Lydia." Just and that, there's one other one. There's Sylvia. Yes.
And you've had a plethora of other creatures.
I've had cats. They find me. They all find me.
As well as things like raccoons.
I have
and
raccoons.
Possums.
I have possums. I have Gila monsters. I have things like that.
And a very small horse. No, I'm kidding.
B. Wrinkly Colin wants to know.
B. Wrinkly Colin?
B. Wrinkly C. Olin, I guess that's it.
A B. Wrinkly Colin?
Well, it's B. Wrinkly worse. C. Olin.
All right.
Wants to know, what are your plans for the future? What are you doing in the future?
Well, let's see. I'm going to pick up Carolyn after this. Okay. I'm working on the Garfield show. I've got to go home and write a Garfield episode.
Can you please tell us about Garfield, your journey with Garfield? Because you've been with Garfield since Garfield, just about since Garfield was born, yeah?
No. I came in, they had done 10 primetime specials before I ever got involved with Garfield.
Well, they're lucky to have you. So can you tell us about Garfield, please?
Well, I was writing a lot of Saturday morning shows, and I had run out of studios to work for. I kept quitting them, or in one case, suing them. I thought I was actually getting out of animation because I had no place else to work. And then they asked me, CBS asked me to do a Michael Jackson cartoon show. This was when that was still sounding like a good idea for kids. And I worked on it with Michael, and I quit it. I just had said, I said, this show will never work. I moonwalked off it. And CBS owed me a lot of money because I had, on this contract, and I said, oh, just forget that, don't pay the money. They said, no, instead we'd like you to write the pilot for a Garfield cartoon show. And I said, the cat? I mean, because they could have meant the president, knowing that place. They said Jim Davis does not want to do a Saturday morning Garfield show because he doesn't think anybody can write the character to his satisfaction, and he doesn't have time to write it himself. He had written all the primetime specials. Jim is fiercely protective and possessive of the cat.
Right, even though he's everywhere.
but you know, there's a guy who works, his schedule makes me look like I'm unemployed. He works constantly, day and night, on every Garfield project. Yeah. You can't make a Garfield belt buckle without him supervising where they punch the holes in it. And so I wrote this pilot, and Jim said, hey, somebody else can write Garfield my way. And he agreed. He went to CBS and said, I will do the show, the Saturday morning Garfield show, if you will hire this guy to write them all.
Wow.
So I started writing them, and yeah.
Was it you guys' idea to include the U.S. Acres stuff?
That was Jim's idea, okay. Because he wanted to. He actually kind of did the show. He had started this newspaper strip called U.S. Acres, mm-hmm. and it was funny. He was considering it a failure, even though it was in enough newspapers to be a big hit by anybody else's standards. He was in like 300 newspapers. Well, if you have 300 newspapers, you're doing great.
Yeah.
But not if your other strip is in 2,600 newspapers. So he wanted to promote U.S. Acres. He originally, when CBS went to him and said, let's put Garfield on Saturday morning, he said, let's put U.S. Acres on instead. And they said, no, we want Garfield. And he said, I want U.S. Acres. So they compromised and put them both in the show.
Yeah, it was a perfect team up, I thought. Yeah. I really fell in love with the show.
And so I did all those for 8 years, whatever it was. We did 121 half hours, and I wrote 121 half hours or had some help on a few of them.
Wow.
But and I started voice directing them, too, because nobody else was going to do it.
And great voice cast on that first
year,
too.
And then the show went off when it was at the peak of its popularity because CBS didn't want to spend any more money on it. It'd gotten too expensive. And they reran them and reran them and reran them. And then one day they came to me and said, let's do a new Garfield show. So I started doing the new Garfield show, which we're now in season three of. We're doing season three at the moment. And next Tuesday, for example, we're going to go in and record an hour special.
Oh, wow.
With Misty as one of our players, our actors, our thespians.
Oh, and you know what? I am like so lucky to be there because this voice cast... Okay, Deuce is not impressed, but this voice cast is...
That's Paul, you're covering.
No!
Yes,
you're covering.
It's actually me.
Yeah.
This voice cast is outrageous. You know, the first time that I ever watched Mark voice direct, and he's very modest about this, and he's probably going to try to interrupt me here, but I'm not going to let him. I remarked to him how fabulous it was watching him, because he lets everybody go. He really lets people do what they do. And... but not only that, he knows exactly what he's looking for. The sessions are done faster than anybody else, and they're done really, really well, and everybody has a great time. And I asked him, how do you do that? And of course, he just waves his hand away and says, well, I just hire brilliant people and just let them do what they do, which is nonsense.
Well, no, it's actually, this is the secret. If you have to give a lot of direction to the actors, you've hired the wrong actors. And if you've hired the wrong actors, you're not a very good director.
Oh, man.
The first cartoon show I ever voice directed, I was writing, I wrote a primetime special for NBC, and they, after the script was done, they said, we got to get a voice director to do this, and they showed me a list of people who were available at the moment. And okay. I looked at the list, and I said, I can't do a worse job than any of these people. It was a terrible list. The people who were, all the people who were good were under contract someplace. The people who were available were just bad voice directors. I knew them all. I thought they were terrible and incompetent. So I said to the guys at NBC, let me direct it. If you will let me hire whoever I want in the cast, I will direct it for nothing.
Whoa.
And nice. They went, you got a deal. Yeah. They love NBC. That was when NBC loved, you know, you could have hosted the Tonight Show then if you offered to do it for free. So
that's what Conan went wrong.
So I went out. Yeah, there, yeah, he wanted to be paid.
Yeah.
So I hired Dawes Butler. I hired Bill Scott, Frank Welker, Peter Cullen, Marvin Kaplan, Howie Morris. A rhesus monkey could have directed
guys?
That session.
Yeah. Oh, you yeah. could ask for a better
oh,
cast.
It was director-proof cast.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the session, Frank Welker, who I already knew, came up to me and he said, Mark, you're the best director, voice director I've worked with in a year, and that's not that much of a compliment, I'm afraid.
Oh.
So, and he's right, because yeah. at that moment, there weren't a lot of good people doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So then I did it a few other times, and when Garfield was going, Jim Davis directed the first couple, and then he said, I don't want to bother flying out to L.A. for these. You go do them, Mark.
Wow.
So I started doing them.
Yeah. See, you seem to do very well in creating personal relationships with these people, that they just trust you to take, you know, these ideas and run with them.
It's not personal relationships, Ezra. Yeah. It's the standard, the high standards of excellence of Mark's work. I can attest to that, because Jim told me that himself.
Well,
and I also think it's the affection that you bring to the property, because you obviously enjoy these, you know, the
aw shucks,
the
aw shucks,
stuff like that.
Can we talk about something other than my excellence for a minute?
No.
No.
Oh, great.
However,
all right.
I will give you a little bit of a break, because we're going to do a part one and part two. And I know that you've got time constraints, but we'd really like to keep you talking if that's okay.
Okay,
and, we'll give you a piece of pizza and we'll come back next week.
Okay,
that's great.
I'm gonna have one piece of pizza for an entire week.
Yeah.
Too slow.
Yeah, make it last.
It's a mastication marathon.
All right.
Well, we'll be back with part two of Evanier next week. I'm Misty Lee.
I'm Paul Dini,
and I'm waiting for pizza.
Bye, everybody.
See you later.
This has been another episode of RadioRashi.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, let us know. You can leave comments and reviews on iTunes or directly on RadioRashi.com. We're also now on social network sites like Twitter and Facebook. Leave us questions or just like us. And don't forget, tell your friends.